Our smell of unkempt old age, and wondered that this should remain of Miss Betterton when all else had gone. Choked with a hopeless pity, she withdrew her arm. Miss Betterton would not have wanted her touch in life. Why impose it on her in death? Reg straightened up. He said, "She's dead. Dead and cold. Looks like she broke her neck. There's nowt anyone can do for her. You'd better go for Father Sebastian." The task of waking Father Sebastian, of finding words to speak and the strength to speak them, horrified Ruby. She would much rather that Reg broke the news, but that would mean she would have to stay alone by the body, and this prospect was even more frightening. For the first time, fear took over from pity. The recesses of the cellar stretched away, great areas of blackness in which imagined horrors lurked. She was not an over-imaginative woman, but now it seemed that the familiar world of routine, of conscientious work, of fellowship and of love was dissolving about her. She knew that Reg only had to stretch out a hand, and the cellar, with its whitewashed walls and labelled racks of wine bottles, would become as familiar and harmless as it was when she and Father Sebastian went down to bring up the bottles for dinner. But Reg didn't stretch out his hand. Everything must be left as it was. Every step seemed mountainous as she climbed the stairs on legs that had suddenly become almost too weak to support her. She switched on all the lights in the hall and stood for a moment gathering her strength before making her way up the two flights to Father Sebastian's flat. Her knock was at first too tentative, and she had to bang on the door before it was opened with disconcerting suddenness and Father Sebastian faced her. She had never seen him before in his dressing gown, and for a moment, disorientated by shock, thought that she was facing a stranger. The sight of her must have shocked him too, for he put out a hand to steady her and drew her into the room. She said, "It's Miss Betterton, Father. Reg and I found her at the bottom of the cellar stairs. I'm afraid she's dead." She was surprised that her voice sounded so steady. Without speaking, Father Sebastian closed his door and hurried with her down the stairs, his hand supporting her arm. At the top of the cellar steps, Ruby waited and watched while he went down and said a few words to Reg, then knelt by the body. After a moment he got to his feet. He spoke to Reg, his voice as usual calm, authoritative. "This has been a shock for you both. I think it would be best if you went on quietly with your usual routine. Commander Dalgleish and I will do what is necessary. It is only work and prayer that will get us through this terrible time." Reg climbed the steps to join her, and together, without speaking, they went into the kitchen. Ruby said, "I suppose they'll be wanting breakfast as usual." "Of course they will, love. They can't face the day on empty stomachs. You heard what Father Sebastian said. We're to go on quietly with our usual routine." Ruby turned piteous eyes on him. "It was an accident, wasn't it?" "Of course it was. It could have happened any time. Poor Father John. This would be terrible for him." But Ruby wondered. It would be a shock, of course. Sudden death always was. But there was no denying that Miss Betterton couldn't have been easy to live with. She reached for her white overall and began with a sad heart to prepare breakfast. Father Sebastian went to his office and rang Dalgleish in Jerome. His call was answered so quickly that it was obvious that the commander was already up. He gave the news, and 5 minutes later they stood together beside the body. Father Sebastian watched as Dalgleish bent down, touched Miss Betterton's face with practiced hands, then stood up and looked down in silent contemplation. Father Sebastian said, "Father John must be told, of course. That is my responsibility. I imagine that he's still asleep, but I must see him before he comes down to the oratory for morning prayer. This will hit him hard. She wasn't an easy woman, but she was his only relation, and they were close." But he made no move to leave. Instead, he asked, "Have you any idea when this happened?" Dalgleish said, From the rigor mortis, I would assume she's been dead about 7 hours. The pathologist may be able to tell us more. It's never possible to be precise from a superficial examination. There will, of course, have to be a post-mortem. Father Sebastian said, "She died after Compline, then, probably as late as midnight. Even so, she must have crossed the hall very quietly. But then she was always quiet. She moved like a grey shadow." He paused and added, "I don't want her brother to see her here, not like this. Surely we could carry her to her room. She wasn't a religious woman, I know. We must respect her sensibilities. She wouldn't want to lie in the church, even if it were open, nor, I think, in the oratory." "She must stay where she is, Father, until the pathologist has examined her. We have to treat this as a suspicious death. But at least we can cover her up. I'll find a sheet." "Yes," said Dalgliesh, "we can certainly cover her." As Father Sebastian turned to the stairs, he asked, "Have you any idea what she was doing here, Father?" Father Sebastian turned back and hesitated. Then he said, "I'm afraid I have. Miss Betterton helped herself to a bottle of wine on a fairly regular basis. All the priests knew about it, and I imagine that the ordinance, perhaps even the staff, may have guessed. She never took more than one bottle about twice a week, and it was never the best wine. Naturally, I discussed the problem with Father John as tactfully as I could. I decided to take no action unless matters got out of hand. Father John regularly paid the price of the wine, at least of those bottles he discovered. Of course, we realized the danger the steep steps posed for an elderly woman. That's why we had the stairs so brightly lit and replaced the rope with the wooden rails." Dalgliesh said, "So, finding you had a regular pilferer in the community, you provided a secure banister rail to facilitate the pilfering and to prevent her from breaking her neck. Do you have difficulty with that, Commander?"
"No. Given your priorities, I don't suppose I do."
He watched as Father Sebastian made his way firmly walking up the steps and disappeared, closing the door behind him. That she had broken her neck, a superficial examination made clear enough. She was wearing a pair of tight-fitting leather slippers, and he had noticed that the sole of the right foot had curled away from the upper. The stairs were brightly lit, and the light switch was at least 2 feet from the first step. Since the light had presumably been on when she fell, she could hardly have stumbled in darkness. But if she had tripped on the first step, surely she would have been found tumbled on the stairs, either face downwards or on her back. On the third stair from the bottom, he had detected what looked like a small smear of blood. From the position of the body, it looked as if she'd been hurled through the air, had struck her head on the stone step and somersaulted over. Surely it would be difficult for her to be flung with such force, unless she had actually run with speed towards the steps. That, of course, was ridiculous. But what if she had been pushed? He felt a depressing and almost overwhelming sense of impotence. If this were murder, given that flapping soul, how could he ever hope to prove it? The death of Margaret Munro was officially from natural causes. Her body had been cremated, her ashes buried or scattered on the earth. How expedient had this present death been for the murderer of Archdeacon Crampton? But for now, the experts in death would take over. Mark Ayling would be called to what might well be a second scene of crime, to assess the time of death, prowl round the body like a predator. Nobby Clark and his team would crawl over the cellar looking for clues they would be most unlikely to find. If there was something that Agatha Betterton had seen or heard, some knowledge which she had unwisely communicated to the wrong person, he was unlikely to learn it now. He waited until Father Sebastian returned with a sheet, which he laid reverently over the body. Then the two of them climbed the cellar steps. Father Sebastian turned out the light and, stretching up, shot the bolt at the top of the cellar door. Mark Ayling arrived with his usual promptness and more than his usual noise. Clattering through the hall with Dalgliesh, he said, "I hope to bring the PM report on Archdeacon Crampton with me, but it's still being typed. Nothing in it to surprise you. death from multiple blows to the head inflicted by a heavy weapon with a sharp edge, i.e. the brass candlestick. Almost certainly killed by the second blow, otherwise a healthy middle-aged male who could have looked forward to drawing his pension. He put on thin latex gloves before cautiously descending the cellar steps. But he didn't this time wait to don his working overalls, and his examination of the body, although not perfunctory, took little time. At the end, getting to his feet, he said, "Dead about 6 hours. Cause of death? A broken neck. Well, you didn't need to call me over to know that. The picture seems clear enough. She fell with force down the steps, struck her forehead on the third step from the bottom, and was flung onto her back. I suppose you're asking yourself the usual question. Did she fall, or was she pushed?"
"I thought of asking you."
"On the face of it, I'd say she was pushed. But you need something more definite than a first impression. I wouldn't be prepared to swear to it in court. The steepness of the stairs is the problem. Could have been designed to kill old ladies. Given that slope, it's perfectly possible that she didn't actually touch the stairs until she struck her head near the bottom. I'd have to say that accidental death is at least as likely as murder. Why the suspicion, by the way? Do you think she saw something on Saturday night? And why was she going to the cellar anyway?"
Dalgleish said cautiously, "She had a habit of wandering at night."
"After the wine, was she?"
Dalgleish didn't reply.
The pathologist clicked shut his case. He said, "I'll send an ambulance for her and get her on the table as soon as possible, but I doubt I'll tell you anything you don't know. Death seems to follow you about, doesn't it? I take a job as locum pathologist while Colby Brooksbank is in New York getting his son married, and I'm called out to more violent deaths than I usually autopsy in 6 months. Have you heard from the coroner's office yet about the date for the Crampton inquest?"
"Not yet."
"You will. He's already been on to me." He took a last look at the body and said with surprising gentleness, "Poor lady. But at least it was quick. 2 seconds of terror, and then nothing. She'd have preferred to die in her bed. But then, wouldn't we all?"
2.
Dalgleish had seen no need to cancel his instruction to Kate to visit Ashcombe House, and by 9 o'clock she and Robbins were on their way. It was a morning of penetrating chill. The first light had spread itself, pink as diluted blood, over the grey waste of sea. A fine drizzle was falling and the air tasted sour. As the windscreen wipers smeared, then cleared the glass, Kate saw a landscape drained of colour in which even the far fields of sugar beet had lost their green brightness. She had to fight down her slight resentment at being chosen for what she privately thought could be a waste of time. A.D. seldom admitted to a hunch, but she knew from her own experience that a detective's strong hunch usually has its roots in reality. A word, a look, a coincidence, something apparently insignificant or unrelated to the main inquiry which takes root in the subconscious and gives rise to that small shoot of unease. Often in the end it withers into inconsequence, but sometimes it provides the vital clue, and only the foolish ignore it. She disliked leaving the scene of the crime with Piers in possession, but there were compensations. She was driving A.D.'s Jaguar, and that was a satisfaction apart from her pleasure in the car. And she wasn't altogether sorry to have a respite from St. Anselm's. She had seldom been part of a murder inquiry in which she had physically and psychologically felt less at home. The college was too masculine, too self-contained, even too claustrophobic for comfort. The priests and ordinands had been unfailingly polite, but it was a courtesy which jarred. They saw her primarily as a woman, not as a police officer. She had thought that that battle had been won. She felt, too, that they were in possession of some secret knowledge, some esoteric source of authority which subtly diminished her own. She wondered whether A.D. and Piers felt the same. Probably not, but then they were men, and St. Anselm's, despite its apparent gentleness, was an almost defiantly masculine world. Furthermore, it was an academic world, and there, too, A.D. and Piers would feel at home. some of her old social and educational insecurities returned. She thought that she had come to terms with them, if not entirely conquered them. It was humiliating that fewer than a dozen black cassocked men could revive those old uncertainties. It was with a positive sense of relief that she turned westward from the cliff-top track, and the pulse of the sea gradually faded. It had beaten for too long in her ears. She would have preferred to have had peers with her. At least they could have discussed the case on terms of equality, sparred and argued, and been more open than she could be with a junior officer. And she was beginning to find Sergeant Robbins irritating. She had always felt him almost too good to be true. She glanced at his boyish, clear-cut profile, at the grey eyes gazing steadily ahead, and wondered again what had led him to choose the police. If he had seen the job as a vocation, well, so had she. She had needed a job in which she could feel useful, where the lack of a university degree wouldn't be seen as a disadvantage, a job which provided stimulus, excitement, and variety. For her, the police service had been a means of putting behind her forever the squalor and poverty of her childhood, the stink of those urine-soaked stairs at Ellison Fairweather Buildings. The service had given her much, including the flat overlooking the Thames, which she could still hardly believe she had achieved. In return, she had given it a loyalty and devotion that sometimes surprised even herself. For Robbins, in his spare time a lay preacher, it was probably a vocation to serve his nonconformist God. She wondered whether what he believed was different from what Father Sebastian believed, and if so, how different and why, but judged the time was not propitious for a theological discussion. What would be the point? In her class at school, there had been 13 different nationalities and almost as many religions. For her, none had been possessed of a coherent philosophy. She told herself that she could live her life without God. She was not sure she could live it without her job. The hospice was in a village southeast of Norwich. Kate said, "We don't want to get tangled with the city. Watch out for the Bramerton turning on the right." 5 minutes later, they had left the A146 and were driving more slowly between denuded hedges behind which clusters of red-roofed bungalows and identical houses proclaimed the spread of suburbia over the green fields. Robin said quietly, "My mum died in a hospice 2 years ago. The usual thing. Cancer. I'm sorry. This visit isn't going to be easy for you." "I'm all right. They were wonderful to mum in the hospice. To us as well." Keeping her eyes on the road, Kate said, "Still, it's bound to bring back painful memories. It's what mum suffered before she went into the hospice that's painful." There was another, longer pause. Then he said, "Henry James called death that distinguished thing." "Oh, God," thought Kate. "First A.D. and his poetry, then Piers, who knows about Richard Hooker, and now Robbins, who reads Henry James. Why can't they send me a sergeant whose idea of a literary challenge is reading Geoffrey Archer?" She said, "I had a boyfriend, a librarian who tried to get me to enjoy Henry James. By the time I got to the end of a sentence, I'd forgotten how it began." Remember that criticism. Some writers bite off more than they can chew. Henry James chews more than he's bitten off. Robin said, "I've only read The Turn of the Screw. That was after I'd seen the TV film. I came across that quote about death somewhere, and it stuck. Sounds good, but it isn't true. Death is like birth. Painful, messy, and undignified. Most of the time, anyway." She thought, "Perhaps it's just as well. Reminds us that we're animals. Maybe we'd do better if we tried to behave more like good animals and less like gods." There was a longer pause. Then Robin said quietly, "Mum's death wasn't without dignity." "Well," thought Kate, "she was one of the lucky ones." They found the hospice without difficulty. It was in the grounds of a solid red brick house on the outskirts of the village. A large sign directed them down a driveway to the right of the house and to a car park. Behind it stretched the hospice, a single-story modern building fronted with a lawn in which two circular beds planted with a variety of low evergreen shrubs and heathers made a brave show of green, purple, and gold. Inside the reception area, the immediate impression was of light, flowers, and busyness. Two people were already at the reception desk. A woman making arrangements to take her husband out for a drive next day, and a clergyman patiently waiting. A baby was wheeled past, her round, bald head ludicrously encircled with a red ribbon adorned with a huge bow in the center. She turned on Kate her bland, incurious gaze. A young girl, obviously with her mother, came in carrying a puppy. The child called out, "We're bringing Trixie to see Granny," and laughed as the puppy slobbered over her ear. A young nurse in a pink overall with a name badge crossed the hall, quietly supporting an emaciated man. Visitors came in with flowers and bags, calling out a cheerful greeting. Kate had expected an atmosphere of reverent calm, but not this sense of purposeful activity, of a stark, functional building given life by the coming and going of people who felt at home in it. When the grey-haired, non-uniformed woman at the reception desk turned to them, she glanced at Kate's identification as if the arrival of two officers from the Metropolitan Police Force was a common occurrence. She said, "You rang earlier, didn't you? Matron, Miss Whetstone, is expecting you. Her office is straight ahead." Miss Whetstone was waiting at the door. Either she was used to her visitors arriving promptly, or she had exceptionally keen ears to catch their coming. She ushered them into a room, the walls of which were three-quarters glass. It was situated at the hub of the hospital, and gave a view of two corridors stretching north and south. The easterly window looked out over a garden which seemed to Kate more institutional than the hospice itself. She saw a carefully tended lawn, with wooden benches at regular intervals round the stone paths, and carefully spaced beds, in which the fading buds of tightly furled roses gave smudges of colour among the denuded bushes. Miss Whetstone waved them to a couple of chairs, seated herself behind the desk, and gave them the encouraging smile of a schoolteacher welcoming not particularly promising new pupils. She was a short, heavily bosomed woman with strong grey hair cut in a fringe above eyes that Kate suspected missed little, but which judged with determined charity. She was wearing a uniform dress in pale blue with a silver-buckled belt and with the hospital badge pinned to her chest. Despite the atmosphere of institutional informality, Ashcombe House obviously believed in the status and virtues of the old-fashioned matron. Kate said, "We're looking into the death of a student at St. Anselm's Theological College. The body was found by Mrs. Margaret Munro, who used to work here before she took the job at St. Anselm's. There's no suggestion whatever that she was concerned in the young man's death, but she did leave a diary with a detailed account of how she found the body. A later entry mentions that the tragedy caused her to remember something which happened in her life 12 years ago. Apparently it was an event which, when she recalled it, caused her concern. We'd like to find out what it was. As she was nursing here 12 years ago, there was a possibility it was something which happened here, someone she met, a patient she nursed. We're wondering whether your records would help. Or perhaps there's someone on the staff who knew her that we could talk to." On the journey, Kate had mentally rehearsed what she would say, selecting, rejecting, and assessing each word and sentence. It had been as much for her own clarification as for Miss Whetstone's. Before setting out, she had been on the point of asking A.D. what exactly she was looking for, but hadn't wanted to betray confusion, ignorance, or reluctance for the job. As if sensing what she had felt, Adam Dalgleish had said, "Something important happened 12 years ago." 12 years ago, Margaret Munro was nursing at Ashcombe House Hospice. 12 years ago, on 30 April 1988, Clara Arbuthnot died in the hospice. The facts may or may not be connected. It's a fishing trip rather than a specific inquiry. Kate had said, I can see that there could be a link between Ronald Treves's death, however that happened, and Mrs. Munro's. I'm still not clear how all this connects with the Archdeacon's murder.
Nor am I, Kate. But I have a feeling that these three deaths, Ronald Treves, Margaret Munro's, and Crampton's, are connected. Not directly, perhaps, but in some way. It's also possible that Margaret Munro was murdered. If she was, then her death and Crampton's are almost certainly linked. I can't believe we've two murderers loose in St. Anselm's. The argument had held a certain credibility at the time. Now, her small prepared speech ended, her doubts returned. Had she over-rehearsed the spiel? Would it have been better to rely on the inspiration of the moment? They weren't helped by Miss Whetstone's clear and skeptical gaze. She said, Let me be sure I've understood you, Inspector. Margaret Munro has recently died of a heart attack, leaving a diary which refers to an event of importance in her life which happened 12 years ago. In connection with some unspecified inquiry, you're anxious to know what this was. Since she worked here 12 years ago, you're suggesting it could be something to do with the hospice. You're hoping that our records might help, or that there might be someone still in post who knew her and would remember incidents of 12 years ago. Kate said, It's a long shot, I know, but the entry was made in the diary, and we have to follow it up. In connection with a boy who was found dead, was that death foul play? There's no suggestion of that, Miss Whetstone. But there has been a recent murder at St. Anselm's, surely? News gets about in the country. Archdeacon Crampton was done to death. Is this visit concerned with that inquiry? We have no reason to suppose it is. Our interest in the diary began before the Archdeacon was murdered.
I see. Well, we all have a duty to help the police, and I have no objection to looking at Mrs. Munro's file and passing on any information that might help you, provided I think that she wouldn't object if she were still with us. I can't believe the file will yield anything useful. Significant events happen frequently at Ashcombe House, including bereavement and death. Kate said, According to our information, a patient died, a Miss Clara Arbuthnot, a month before Mrs. Munro took up her post here. We are anxious to check the dates. We'd like to know if there was a chance that the two women did meet. That seems highly unlikely unless they met outside Ashcombe House. However, I can check the dates for you. All our records are now, of course, on computer, but we haven't gone back as far as 12 years. We only keep the staff records in case prospective employers ask us for a reference. Both these files are in the main house. There may be information on Miss Arbuthnot's medical record that I regard as confidential. You'll understand I can't pass that on. Kate said, It would be helpful if we could see both files, Mrs. Munro's record of employment and Miss Arbuthnot's medical record.
I don't think I could allow that. Of course, this situation is unusual. I've never been faced with this kind of request before. You've hardly been forthcoming about your interest either in Mrs. Munro or in Miss Arbuthnot. I think I should have a word with Mrs. Barton. She's our chairman, before we go any further.
Before Kate had decided how to respond, Robin said, If all this sounds vague, it's because we don't ourselves know what we're looking for. We only know that something important happened in Mrs. Munro's life 12 years ago. She seems to have been a lady with few interests outside her job, and it's possible that it was something to do with Ashcombe House. Couldn't you have a look at the two files to check we've got the dates right? If there's nothing on Mrs. Munro's file that seems to you significant, then I'm afraid we've been wasting your time. If there is something, then you could consult Mrs. Barton before deciding whether it would be right to reveal it. Miss Whetstone looked at him steadily for a moment.
That seems sensible. I'll see if I can lay hands on the records. It may take a little time.
At that moment the door was opened, and a nurse put her head round. The ambulance has just arrived, Miss Whetstone, with Mrs. Wilson. Her daughters are with her. Miss Whetstone's face immediately brightened into happy expectancy. She might have been welcoming a fellow guest into a prestigious hotel.
Good, good. I'll come. I'll come now.
We're putting her in with Helen, aren't we? I think she'll be more comfortable with someone her own age. She turned to Kate. I'll be busy for a little time. Do you want to come back or wait? Kate felt that their physical presence in her office offered the best hope of getting the information quickly. She said, We'll wait, if we may please. But after hearing the first two words, Miss Whetstone was out of the door. Kate said, Thank you, Sergeant. That was helpful. She strode over to the window and stood quietly watching the comings and goings in the corridor. Glancing at Robbins, she saw that his face was white and set in a mask of endurance. She thought she could detect a bead of moisture at the corner of his eye and quickly looked away. She thought, I'm not as good or as kind as I used to be 2 years ago. What's happening to me? A.D. was right when I spoke to him. If I can't give this job what it needs, and that includes humanity, maybe I'd be better leaving. Thinking of Dalgleish, she wished with a sudden intensity that he were there. She smiled, remembering how, in such a situation, he could never resist the lure of words. It sometimes seemed to her that his reading was an obsession. He would be too scrupulous to study the papers left on the desk, unless they were relevant to the inquiry, but he would certainly be moving over to study the numerous notices on the large cork board which obscured part of the window. Neither she nor Robin spoke, and they remained standing as they had been when Miss Whetstone got up from her chair. They were not kept waiting long. It was just under a quarter of an hour when she returned with two folders and again seated herself at her desk and laid them before her. "Do sit down, please," she said. Kate felt like a candidate at an interview awaiting the humiliating exposure of an unimpressive record. Miss Whetstone had obviously studied the files before returning. She said, "I'm afraid there's nothing here to help you. Margaret Munro came to us on 1 June 1988 and left on 30 April 1994. She was suffering from a deteriorating condition of the heart and was strongly recommended by her doctor to seek less demanding work. She went, as you know, to St. Anselm's mainly to look after the linen and to undertake such minor nursing tasks as might be expected in a small college consisting mostly of healthy young men. There's little on her record except the usual applications for annual leave, medical certificates, and an annual confidential report. I arrived 6 months after she left, so have no personal knowledge of her, but she seems to have been a conscientious and sympathetic, if unimaginative, nurse. The lack of imagination may have been a virtue. The lack of sentimentality certainly was. No one here is ever helped by over-emotionalism. Kate said, And Miss Arbuthnot? Clara Arbuthnot died a month before Margaret Munro came to us. She can't therefore have been nursed by Mrs. Munro, and if they did meet, it wasn't here as patient and nurse. Kate asked, Did Miss Arbuthnot die alone? No patient dies alone here, Inspector. Certainly she had no relations, but a priest, a Reverend Hubert Johnson, saw her at her request before she died. Kate said, Would it be possible to speak to him, Miss Whetstone? Miss Whetstone said dryly, That, I'm afraid, is beyond the capacity even of the Metropolitan Police. He was a patient here at the time, receiving a temporary period of care, and died here 2 years later. So there's no one now who has any personal memory of Mrs. Munro's life 12 years ago. Shirley Legg is our longest-serving staff member. We don't have a high turnover, but the work does make very special demands, and we take the view that it's probably wise for nurses to have a change from terminal cases from time to time. I think she's the only nurse who was here 12 years ago, although I would have to check. Frankly, Inspector, I haven't the time. You could certainly have a word with Mrs. Legg. I think she's on duty. Kate said, I'm afraid we're being something of a nuisance, but it would be helpful to see her. Thank you. Again, Miss Whetstone disappeared, leaving the two records on her desk. Kate's first impulse was to take a look at them, but something stopped her. Partly it was her belief that Miss Whetstone had been honest with them and that there was nothing more to be learned, and partly a realization that their every movement was visible through the glass partition. Why antagonize Miss Whetstone now? It wouldn't help the inquiry. The matron returned 5 minutes later with a sharp-featured, middle-aged woman whom she introduced as Mrs. Shirley Legg. Mrs. Legg wasted no time. Matron says you're asking about Margaret Munro. Afraid I can't help you. I did know her, but not all that well. She didn't go in for close friendships. I remember she was a widow and had this son who'd won a scholarship to some public school or other. I can't remember which. He was keen on going into the army, and I think they were paying for him at university before he took a commission. Something like that, anyway. I'm sorry to hear she's dead. I think there were only the two of them, so it'll be tough on the son. Kate said, the son died before her, killed in Northern Ireland. Well, that would have been hard for her. I don't suppose she cared much about dying herself after that happened. The boy was her life. Sorry, I can't be more helpful. If anything important did happen to her while she was here, she didn't tell me. You could try Mildred Fawcett. She turned to Miss Whetstone. You remember Mildred, Miss Whetstone? She retired shortly after you arrived. She knew Margaret Munro. I think they trained together at the old Westminster Hospital. Might be worth having a word. Kate said, Miss Whetstone, are you likely to have her address on record? It was Shirley Legg who answered. No need to bother. I can tell you that. We still exchange Christmas cards, and she's got the kind of address that sticks in the memory. It's a cottage just outside Medgrave, off the A146. Clippity-clop Cottage. I think there used to be farm horses stabled nearby. So here at last they had struck lucky. Mildred Fawcett might well have retired to a cottage in Cornwall or to the northeast. Instead, Clippity-Clop Cottage was directly on their road to St. Anselm's. Kate thanked Miss Whetstone and Shirley Legg for their help and asked if they could have a look at the local telephone directory. Here again they were lucky. Miss Fawcett's number was listed. A wooden box on the counter of the reception desk was labelled Flowers Fund, and Kate folded and slipped in a £5 note. She doubted whether this was legitimate expenditure of police funds, and she wasn't sure whether the gesture had been one of generosity or a small superstitious offering to fate. 3. Back in the car, their seat belts fastened, Kate rang Clippity-Clop Cottage but got no reply. She said, I'd better report on progress, or the lack of it. The conversation was brief. Putting down the telephone, she said, We see Mildred Fawcett as planned, if we can reach her. Then he wants us back as quickly as possible. The pathologist has just left. Did A.D. say how it happened? Was it an accident? Too early to tell, but that's what it looks like. And if it wasn't, how the hell can we prove it? Robin said, The fourth death. All right, Sergeant, I can count. She drove carefully out of the drive, but once on the road increased her speed. Miss Betterton's death was unsettling in more ways than its initial impact of shock. Kate wasn't unusual in needing to feel that the police, once on the job, were in command. An investigation might go well or ill, but it was they who questioned, probed, dissected, assessed, decided on strategy, and held the cords of control. But there was something about the Crampton murder, an anxiety, subtle and unvoiced, which had lain at the back of her mind almost from the beginning, but which until now she hadn't faced. It was the realization that the power might lie elsewhere. That despite Dalgleish's intelligence and experience, there was another mind at work, equally intelligent and with a different experience. She feared that the control, which once lost, could never be regained, might already have slipped from their hands. She was impatient to be back at St. Anselm's as soon as possible. In the meantime, it was pointless to speculate. So far, their journey had produced nothing that was new. She said, "Sorry, I was short. There's no point in discussing it until we have more facts. For now, we concentrate on finishing the job in hand." Robin said, "If we're on a wild goose chase, at least they're flying in the right direction." Once they approached Medbrave, Kate slowed down almost to a crawl. More time would be lost by missing the cottage than by driving slowly. She said, "You look to the left, I'll take the right. We could always ask, but I'd rather not. I don't want to advertise our visit." It wasn't necessary to ask. As they approached the village, she saw a neat brick and tile cottage standing some 40 feet back from the green verge on a slight rise of the road. A whiteboard on the gate bore the name in carefully painted bold black letters, Clippity-Clop Cottage. It had a central porch with the date 1893 carved in stone above it and two identical bow windows on the ground floor, with a line of three above. The paintwork was a shiny white, the window panes glittered, and the flagstones leading to the front door were free of weeds. The immediate impression was of order and comfort. There was room to park on the verge, and they moved up the path to an iron knocker in the shape of a horseshoe. There was no reply. Kate said, "Probably out, but it's worth going round the back." The early drizzle had ceased, and although the air was still sharp, the day had lightened and there were threads of barely discernible blue in the eastern sky. A stone path to the left of the house led to an unlocked gate and into the garden. Kate, born and bred in the inner city, knew little of gardening, but she could see at once that an enthusiast had been at work. The spacing of the trees and shrubs, the careful design of the beds, and the neat vegetable patch at the end showed that Miss Fawcett was an expert. The slight rise of the ground meant, too, that she had a view. The autumn landscape stretched untrammeled in all its varied greens, golds, and browns under the wide East Anglian sky. A woman, hoe in hand, bending over one of the beds, rose as they approached and came towards them. She was tall and gypsy-like, with a brown face deeply wrinkled, and black hair hardly touched with grey combed tightly back and fastened at the nape of her neck. She was wearing a long woolen skirt with an apron of sacking over it, with a wide central pocket, heavy shoes, and gardening gloves. She seemed neither surprised nor disconcerted to see them. Kate introduced herself and Sergeant Robbins, showed her identification, and repeated the essentials of what she had previously said to Miss Whetstone. She added, "They weren't able to help at the hospice, but Mrs. Shirley Legg said that you were there 12 years ago and knew Mrs. Munro. We found your number and did try to telephone, but there was no reply." "I expect I was at the bottom of the garden. Friends tell me I should have a mobile, but that's the last thing I want. They're an abomination. I've given up travelling by train until they introduce mobile-free compartments." Unlike Miss Whetstone, she asked no questions. One might imagine, thought Kate, that visits from two officers of the Metropolitan Police were a regular occurrence. She gazed at Kate steadily, then said, "You'd better come in, and I'll see if I can help." They were led through a brick-floored pantry with a deep stone sink under the window and fitted bookshelves and cupboards along the opposite wall. There was a smell of moist earth and apples with a trace of paraffin. The room was obviously used partly as a tool shed and storeroom. Kate's eyes took in a box of apples on the shelf, onions threaded on a string, swathes of twine, buckets, a curled garden hose on a hook, and a rack of garden tools, all clean. Miss Fawcett took off her apron and shoes and preceded them barefooted into the sitting room. It spoke to Kate of a self-contained and solitary life. There was one high-backed armchair in front of the fire with an angled lamp on a table to the left, and another table on the right holding a pile of books. A round table in front of the window was set for one person, and the remaining three chairs had been pushed back against the wall. A large ginger cat was curled, plump as a cushion, on a low button-backed chair. At their entry, he raised a ferocious head, gazed fixedly at them, then, affronted, descended from the chair and lumbered out to the pantry. They heard the click of a cat flap. Kate thought she had never seen an uglier cat. Miss Fawcett pulled out two straight-backed chairs, then went to a cupboard fitted in the alcove to the left of the fireplace. She said, "I don't know whether I can help you, but if something important did happen to Margaret Munro when we were both nursing at the hospice, I probably mentioned it in my diary. My father insisted that we keep diaries as children, and the habit has stuck. It's rather like insisting on prayers before bed. Once begun in childhood, there's an obligation to conscience to keep going, however disagreeable. You said 12 years ago. That would bring us to 1988. She settled down in the chair before the fire and picked up what looked like a child's exercise book. Kate said, "Do you remember whether you nursed a Miss Clara Arbuthnot when you worked at Ashcombe House?" If Miss Fawcett thought the sudden mention of Clara Arbuthnot odd, she didn't say so. She said, "I remember Miss Arbuthnot. I was the nurse, chiefly responsible for her care from the day of her admission until she died 5 weeks later." She took her spectacle case from her skirt pocket and turned over the pages of the diary. It took a little time to find the right week. As Kate feared, Miss Fawcett's interest was caught by other entries. Kate wondered if she was being deliberately slow. After a minute, she sat silently reading, then pressed both hands over the entry. Once again, Kate experienced her keen, intelligent gaze. She said, "There's a mention here of both Clara Arbuthnot and Margaret Munro. I find myself in some difficulty. I promised secrecy at the time, and I see no reason now to break my word." Kate thought before speaking, then she said, "The information you have there may be crucial to us for other reasons than an ordnance apparent suicide. It really is important that we know what you have written, and know as soon as possible. Clara Arbuthnot and Margaret Munro are both dead. Do you think they would wish you to remain silent if it's a matter of helping justice?" Miss Fawcett got to her feet. She said, "Will you please take a walk in the garden for a few minutes? I'll knock on the window when I want you back. I need to think about this on my own." They left her still standing. Outside, they walked shoulder to shoulder to the far end of the garden and stayed looking out over the scarred fields. Kate was tormented with impatience. She said, "That diary was only a few feet away. All I needed was a quick glance. And what do we do if she won't say anything more? Okay, there's always a subpoena if the case goes to court, but how do we know that the diary's relevant? It's probably an entry describing how she and Munro went to Frinton and had sex under the pier." Robin said, "There isn't a pier at Frinton. And Miss Arbuthnot was dying. Oh, well, we'd better stroll back. I don't want to miss the knock on the window." When it came, they went back into the sitting room quietly, anxious not to betray impatience. Miss Fawcett said, "I have your word that the information you seek is necessary to your present investigation, and that, if it proves irrelevant, no note will be taken of what I say." Kate said, "We can't tell Miss Fawcett whether it will be relevant or not. If it is, then of course it will have to come out, possibly even in evidence. I can't give any assurances. I can only ask you to help." Miss Fawcett said, "Thank you for your honesty. As it happens, you are fortunate. My grandfather was a chief constable, and I am one of that generation, sadly decreasing, who still trust the police. I'm prepared to tell you what I know, and also to hand over the diary if the information is useful." Kate judged that further argument was unnecessary and might be counterproductive. She simply said, "Thank you," and waited. Miss Fawcett said, "I've been thinking while you were in the garden. You told me that this visit arises from the death of a student at St. Anselm's College. You also said that there was no suggestion that Margaret Munro was involved in that death except when she found the body. But there has to be more to it than that, doesn't there? You wouldn't be here.
a detective inspector and a sergeant unless there was suspicion of foul play. This is a murder inquiry, isn't it?
Yes, said Kate, it is. We are part of a team investigating the murder of Archdeacon Crampton at St. Anselm's College. There may be absolutely no link with Mrs. Munro's diary entry, but it's something we have to check. I expect you know about the Archdeacon's death.
No, said Miss Fawcett. I don't know. I very seldom buy a daily newspaper, and I've no television.
Murder makes a difference.
There's an entry in my diary for 27 April 1988, and it does concern Mrs. Munro. My problem is that at the time, we both promised secrecy.
Kate said, Miss Fawcett, could I please see the entry?
I don't think it would be very illuminating if you did. I wrote down a few of the details, but I remember more than I've recorded here. I think I have a duty to tell you, although I doubt whether it has anything to do with your inquiry, and I have your assurance that, if it isn't, the matter will be taken no further.
Kate said, We can promise you that. Miss Fawcett sat stiffly upright, her palms pressed against the open pages of the diary as if to shield them from prying eyes. She said, In April 1988 I was nursing terminally ill patients at Ashcombe House. This, of course, you already know. One of my patients told me that she wished to marry before she died, but that her intention and the ceremony were to be kept secret. She asked me to be a witness. I agreed. It wasn't my place to ask questions, and I asked none. This was a wish expressed by a patient of whom I had become fond and who I knew had little time left to live. The surprise was that she had the strength for the ceremony. It was arranged by Archbishop's license and took place at midday on the 27th at the small church St. Othith's at Clamstoke Lacey outside Norwich. The priest was the Reverend Hubert Johnson, whom my patient had met at the hospice. I didn't see the bridegroom until he arrived by car to collect the patient and myself, ostensibly for a country drive. Father Hubert was to find a second witness, but failed to do so. I can't now remember what went wrong. As we were leaving the hospice, I saw Margaret Munro. She was just leaving after her interview with the matron for a nursing post. It was, in fact, at my suggestion that she had applied. I knew that I could rely on her absolute discretion. We trained together at the old Westminster Hospital in London, although she was, of course, considerably younger than myself. I was a late entry to nursing after a brief academic career. My father was strongly opposed to my choice of profession, and I had to wait until he died before I could apply for training. The wedding ceremony took place, and the patient and I returned to the hospice. She seemed much happier and more at peace in those last days. But neither she nor I spoke again of the marriage. So much happened during my years at the hospice that I doubt whether I would have recalled it without this entry if I hadn't had an earlier inquiry. Seeing the written words, even without her name, brought it back with astonishing clarity. It was a beautiful day. I remember the graveyard at St. Osyth's was yellow with daffodils, and we came out of the porch into sunshine. Kate said, Was the patient Clara Arbuthnot? Miss Fawcett looked at her. Yes, it was. And the bridegroom? I've no idea. I can't recall his face or his name, and I doubt whether Margaret would have been able to help if she'd been alive.
Kate said, But she would have signed the marriage certificate as a witness, and surely the names would have been mentioned.
I imagine they would, but there was no particular reason why she should remember. After all, at a church wedding, only Christian names are used during the service.
She paused and then said, I have to confess that I haven't been entirely open with you. I wanted time to think, to consider how much, if anything, I should reveal. I had no need to consult the diary before answering your question. I'd looked up that date before. On Thursday, 12 October, Margaret Munro telephoned me from a call box in Lowestoft.
She asked me the name of the bride, and I told her. I couldn't give her the name of the groom. It isn't recorded in my diary, and, if I ever knew it, it's long since forgotten. Kate said, Is there anything at all you remember about the bridegroom? His age? What he looked like? How he spoke? Did he ever come again to the hospice? No, not even when Clara was dying, and as far as I know, he had no part in the cremation service. That was arranged by a firm of solicitors in Norwich. I never saw or heard from him again. There was one thing, though. I noticed it when we stood before the altar and he was putting the ring on Clara's finger. The top part of the ring finger on his left hand was missing. Kate's surge of triumph and excitement was so exhilarating that she feared that it must show on her face. She didn't glance at Robbins. Keeping her voice steady, she asked, Did Miss Arbuthnot ever confide in you about the reason for the marriage? Is it possible, for example, that there was a child involved? A child? She never spoke of having a child, and as far as I recall, there was no mention of a pregnancy on her medical records. No child ever visited her. But then neither did the man she married. So she told you nothing. Only that she planned to marry, that the marriage must be kept absolutely secret, and that she needed my help. I gave it. Is there anyone she might have confided in? The priest who married her, Father Hubert Johnson, spent a great deal of time with her before she died. I remember that he gave her Holy Communion and heard her confession. I had to ensure that they weren't disturbed when he was with my patient. She must have told him everything, either as a friend or as a priest. But he was seriously ill himself at the time, and died 2 years later. There was nothing more to be learned, and after thanking Miss Fawcett for her help, Kate and Robbins returned to the car. Miss Fawcett was watching them from the door of the cottage, and Kate drove out of sight before finding a suitable place on the grass verge to bring the Jaguar to a stop. She took up the telephone and said with satisfaction, Something positive to report. We're getting somewhere, at last. 4. After lunch, as Father John did not appear, Emma went up and knocked at the door of his private apartment. She dreaded seeing him, but when he opened the door he looked very much as he always did. His face brightened and he welcomed her in. She said, Father, I'm so sorry, so dreadfully sorry, and held back her tears. She told herself she had come to speak words of comfort, not to add to his distress. But it was like comforting a child. She wanted to take him in her arms. He led her to the chair before the fire, the chair which she guessed was his sister's, and sat opposite her. He said, I wonder if you would do something for me, Emma. Of course, anything, Father. It's her clothes. I know they'll have to be sorted and given away. It seems very early to be thinking of that now, but I expect you'll be leaving us by the end of the week, and I wondered whether you would do it. A Mrs. Pilbeam would help, I know. She's very kind, but I'd rather it were you. Perhaps tomorrow, if that's convenient. Of course I will, Father. I'll do it after my afternoon seminar. He said, Everything she owned is in her bedroom. There should be some jewelry. If there is, will you take it and sell it for me? I'd like the money to go to some charity concerned with helping prisoners. I think there must be one. Emma said, I'm sure there is, Father. I'll find out for you. But wouldn't you like to look at the jewelry first and decide if there's anything you'd like to keep? No, thank you, Emma. That's thoughtful, but I'd rather it all went. There was a silence. Then he said, The police were here this morning, examining the flat and her room. Inspector Tarrant came with one of those search officers in white coats. He introduced him as Mr. Clark. Emma's voice was sharp. Search the flat for what? They didn't say. They weren't here for long, and they left everything very tidy. You wouldn't have known that they'd been here. There was another pause. Then he said, Inspector Tarrant asked me where I'd been and what I did last night between Compline and 6 o'clock. Emma cried, "But that's intolerable." He smiled sadly. "No, not really. They have to ask these questions." Inspector Tarrant was very tactful. He was only doing his duty. Emma reflected angrily that much of the world's grief was caused by people who claimed that they were only doing their duty. Father John's quiet voice broke in. "The pathologist was here, but I expect you heard him arrive." "The whole community must have heard him. It wasn't a discreet arrival." Father John smiled. "No, it wasn't, was it? He didn't stay long, either. Commander Dalglish asked me if I wanted to be there when they took the body away, but I said I'd rather stay here quietly by myself. After all, it wasn't Agatha they were taking away. She had gone long ago." Gone long ago. What exactly, Emma wondered, did he mean? The three words clanged in her mind as sonorous as a funeral bell. Getting up to go, she took his hand again and said, "I'll see you tomorrow then, Father, when I come to parcel up the clothes. Are you sure there's nothing else I can do?" He thanked her, then said, "There is just one other thing. I hope I'm not imposing on your goodness, but will you please find Raphael? I haven't seen him since it happened, but I'm afraid this will distress him greatly. He was always kind to her, and I know that she loved him." She found Raphael standing on the edge of the cliff, about 100 yards from the college. When she reached him, he sat down on the grass and she joined him and put out her hand. Staring out to sea and without turning to her, he said, "She was the only one here who cared for me." Emma cried, "That isn't true, Raphael. You know it isn't. I mean cared for me. Myself. Raphael. Not as the object of general benevolence, not as a suitable candidate for the priesthood, not as the last surviving Arbuthnot, even if I am a bastard. You must have been told. Dumped here as a baby in one of those straw baby carriers, squashy, with a handle both sides. Leaving me in the rushes by the mere would have been more appropriate. But perhaps my mother thought I wouldn't be discovered there. At least she cared enough to dump me at the college where I'd be found. They didn't have much choice about taking me in. Still, it's given them 25 years of feeling benevolent, exercising the virtue of charity." "You know that isn't how they feel. It's how I feel. I know I sound egotistical and self-pitying. I am egotistical and self-pitying. You don't have to tell me. I used to think everything would be all right if I could get you to marry me." "Raphael, that's ridiculous. When you're thinking clearly, you know it is. Marriage isn't therapy. But it would have been something definite. It would have anchored me." "Doesn't the church anchor you?" "It will once I'm priested. No going back then." Emma thought carefully for a moment, then said, "You don't have to be ordained. It has to be your decision. No one else's. If you're not certain, you shouldn't go ahead." "You sound like Gregory. If I mention the word vocation, he tells me not to talk like a character in a Graham Greene novel. We'd better be going back." He paused, then laughed. She was a terrible nuisance in some ways, on those trips to London. But I never wished I was with anyone else. He got to his feet and began striding towards the college. Emma made no attempt to catch him up. Walking more slowly on the edge of the cliff, she felt a great sadness for Raphael, for Father John, and for all the people she loved at St. Anselm's. She had reached the iron gate into the west court when she heard a voice calling, and turning, saw Karen Surtees walking briskly towards her across the scrubland. They had seen each other on previous weekends, when both had been in college, but had never spoken except to exchange an occasional good morning. Despite this, Emma had never felt that there was antagonism between them. She waited with some curiosity to know what would be said now. Karen glanced back towards St. John's cottage before speaking.
Sorry to shout at you like that. I just wanted a word. What's all this about old Betterton being found dead in the cellar? Father Martin came over to tell us this morning, but he wasn't exactly forthcoming. There seemed no reason to conceal what little she knew. Emma said, I think she tripped on the top step. Or was she pushed? Anyway, this is one death they can't try to pin on Eric or me. That is, if she died before midnight. We drove to Ipswich last night to see a film and have dinner. We wanted to get out of the place for an hour or so. I suppose you've no idea how the investigation is going. I mean the Archdeacon's murder. Emma said, none at all. The police don't tell us anything. Not even a handsome commander? No, I suppose he wouldn't. God, that man's sinister. I wish to hell he'd get a move on. I want to get back to London. Anyway, I'm staying on here with Eric until the end of the week. There's just one thing I wanted to ask you. You may not be able to help, or you may not want to, but I can't think of anyone else to ask. Are you a churchgoer? Do you take communion? The question was so unexpected that Emma was for a moment disorientated. Karen said almost impatiently, I mean in church, Holy Communion, do you take it? Yes, sometimes. I'm wondering about the wafers they hand out. What happens? I mean, do you open your mouth and they pop them in, or do you hold out your hands? The conversation was bizarre, but Emma answered. Some people open their mouths, but in Anglican churches it's more usual to hold up your palms, one over the other. And I suppose the priest stands and watches you while you actually eat the wafer. He might, if he's speaking all the words of the prayer book service over you. But usually he passes along to the next communicant, and then there could be a short wait while either he or another priest comes with the chalice. She asked, why do you need to know? No particular reason. It's something I'm curious about. I thought I might go to a service, and I don't want to get it wrong or make a fool of myself. But don't you have to be confirmed? I mean, they'll probably turn me away. Emma said, I don't think that would happen. There'll be a mass in the oratory tomorrow morning. She added, not without a tinge of mischief. You could tell Father Sebastian you'd like to attend. He'll probably ask you a few questions. He might want you to go to confession first. Confess to Father Sebastian? Are you mad? I think I'll wait for spiritual regeneration until I get back to London. By the way, how long are you thinking of staying? Emma said, I should go on Thursday.